and this is Dr. Stan here on Radio Liberty. Coming to you from the mountains overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it will be reality and not illusion or delusion that will determine what the future will bring. Well, this afternoon we have with us a very special guest, Dr. Charles Crenshaw. And Dr. Crenshaw is a clinical professor of surgery at Southwestern Medical School. He is the director and chairman of the Department of Surgery at John Peter Smith Hospital in Fort Worth. But he's going to talk to us this afternoon about a book he wrote entitled JFK, Conspiracy of Silence. Because at one moment in history, he was a person who witnessed what happened when former President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was wheeled into the emergency room at Parkland Hospital in Dallas in November of 1963. He was a resident in surgery at that time, and he has an amazing story to tell that few Americans have heard. Dr. Crenshaw, are you with us?
Good afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, and I appreciate this taking time from your busy schedule to be with me and with the listeners to our radio program. But I felt that your story was so important, and I feel that many Americans really haven't heard it. So I hope that you can tell us really the events as they transpired. Do you want to pick up the story, or shall we just go point from point from the book?
Either way, whichever you would prefer. I was a third-year surgical resident there on a elective surgical team, and we were preparing to go home. We'd done the one cholecystectomy or gallbladder, and I was happy to be off that afternoon. Obviously, I knew the president was going to be in Dallas, but the idea of getting off and going to the parade was not even in my mind. I was happy to just get off of the rotation that day. Dr. Shires, our chief of surgery, was my mentor, and I took care of the B surgery was his team. So I was sitting there writing orders after the operation had ended, and they paged Dr. Shires' stat. Well, one of the things, as you well know, in a teaching hospital, they never page the chief of surgery stat. So I picked up the phone, told him that Dr. Shires was out of town in Galveston, and asked him what was wrong. And they said the president had been shot, and they were bringing him to the emergency room. I slammed the phone down, ran through the double doors, down the hall to the surgery, to the OR suite, and there I found Dr. Robert McClellan standing at the posting board. I was so thrilled to see someone who was a staff man that I literally grabbed him around the waist and pulled him with me as we ran through the anesthesia conference room, down to back to a set of stairs, and down two floors we went into the emergency room. As you all well know, and most people, a trauma room or emergency room is sheer bedlam anyway. But what we saw when we hit the emergency room in Parkland was beyond belief. There were people running all over the place, screaming. FBI, the Secret Service, did not know one another. At one time, we were running through the emergency room toward trauma room one. A man came in, and he was immediately slammed across the chest with another man from a gun. One was the FBI agent, one was the Secret Service. We saw briefly out of the left of my eye, then Vice President Johnson coming in, who was holding his chest, and I, being a Texan, I wondered whether or not he had sustained another coronary. But we were heading to trauma room one, so we ran into trauma room one, and there on the gurney, the cart, was the President of the United States, and probably the first person I really came in contact with was Mrs. Kennedy, who was standing there at the end with an aide who ended up being Admiral Berkeley. But most of all, Bob and I came in. I took the right leg. He went up to the top. Dr. Jim Caracas, who's chief of surgery now at Southwestern, was the first resident physician who saw Kennedy when he was brought in. And he put in place an endotracheal tube. Dr. Malcolm Perry was the first staff man there, and he ran in and was at the top with Dr. Carrico. Then Dr. Baxter and Dr. Peters came in from the medical school, and they were at the right arm. arm, and Dr. Jones and Dr. McCullum were at the left arm. It was immediately apparent to Dr. Perry that the endotracheal tube was not working. There was bubbling coming from this entrance wound in the lower third of the neck. So it was his decision to immediately do a tracheostomy. So a tracheostomy was performed by Dr. Perry. By his own description, it was 1 inch. By Carrico's description, it was 1.5 inches. But it was no longer than the flange on the tracheostomy tube.
Now, just for the, if I may interrupt you for a minute, sure. The important thing is that, as far as you were concerned, the bullet wound in the neck was a wound of entrance, not a wound of exit, as we've been told.
Absolutely. I had been in surgery for 3 years there. We had seen bullet wounds of all caliber there at Parkland. And I've been in practice as a head of a department of surgery that is just a small Parkland for 30 years. There's never been any question in my mind that it was an entrance wound in the lower third of the neck.
Okay, fine. So they did the tracheostomy, and then what happened?
The tracheostomy was put in place, but again, the lungs were not, or the chest wall was not moving very well. So Dr. Baxter and Dr. Perry on the right put in an anterior chest tube. Dr. Jones and Dr. McCullum on the left put in an anterior chest tube under water seal drains to try to expand the lungs. By then, Dr. Pepper Jenkins, the chief of anesthesia, had gotten some electrodes on for an elemental EKG. We called it a torpedo back in that time. Dr. Kemp Clark had now arrived from the medical school. He's the chief of neurosurgery, was looking at the grave wound, and the wound of death was the hole in the back of the head in the occipital parietal. It ended up being the size of my fist.
Now, was that a wound of entry for the behind, as far as the head was concerned?
It was an exit wound.
It was an exit wound, too.
It was a tangent coming from the side behind the right ear, knocking out the bone, scalp, and brain tissue, was falling from the head onto the cart into the kick bucket. This hole was the size of my fist.
Okay, fine.
So the electrodes were put in place, and it was a straight line. Then the chief of electrocardiography came in. He had a more sophisticated machine. These electrodes were put in place, and again, there was a straight line. Dr. Perry started a closed chest massage, and then he was spelled by Dr. Clark. But after about 4 or 5 minutes, again, there was no change in the EKG. And we faced what we trained for in trauma, the loss of the President of the United States.
Dr. Crenshaw, I'm going to have to interrupt you here for just a minute because we have to do some business, and I have to play a commercial here. But we'll be back in just 2 minutes after we hear a little bit about Congressman Ron Paul, who's a fellow Texan.
Yes.
Who was in Congress, and we're advertising his newsletter here, hoping people will want to get it and help keep our program on the air. So if you'll be a little patient here. Why, we'll be back in just 2 minutes after we hear about Ron Paul.
Americans ever to serve in the House of Representatives was Dr. Ron Paul of Texas. As a member of the House Banking Committee, he found out what was really going on behind the scenes. Dr. Paul continues to inform and warn the public on financial and monetary matters in his Ron Paul Survival Report. In times like these, you need information you can count on. A 1-year subscription to Ron Paul's Survival Report with special bonus offers, the book, the New Money Survival Handbook, and 4 special reports, Safety Net Investing, Profitable Precious Money Speculation, Race Terrorism in America, and the Ron Paul Primer on Coins, plus his unlisted telephone number for fast-breaking news. All of this is available for $99 simply by calling Radio Liberty at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-544-8927.
Now, this is Dr. Stan back here with Dr. Charles Crenshaw telling the story of what happened at Parkland Hospital that November day in 1963. Well, Dr. Crenshaw, you were saying that it looked like the president was going to die. There's really not much you could do at that point. Now, ordinarily, a murder would be something that would be taken care of and investigated in the Dallas area. You'd ordinarily carry out the autopsy and try to find out who was responsible for it there.
Absolutely. This is Texas law, as I'm sure it is in most states. And so there was no question in my mind that the post-mortem examination would be done there so that the evidence could be used in a court in Texas. However, this was not to be. Everyone there stayed at the inn. He was not pronounced dead until after the police came in. Mrs. Kennedy and probably, I'm told, Attorney General Kennedy had asked for a priest, and so he arrived. So he pulled the sheet up over the body and covered the wound in the head. Mrs. Kennedy then came in, and Father Huber, Catholic priest, came in. He intoned the last rites, and we all stood there, not knowing, but feeling. Of all things, we trained to do this, and we could not save our president. However, after that, almost everyone left. But as I said, being the leader of the B team, I stayed there because of the probable autopsy. And Mrs. Kennedy was sitting outside the room, and as I ducked my head outside the room, there was a large commotion going on between the Secret Service and various members of pathology staff. Now, the chief of forensic pathologists and the chief of Dallas County was Dr. Earl Rose. So Dr. Vernon Stembridge, the surgical chief of pathology, was explaining to the Secret Service that there had to be an autopsy performed there at Parkland. However, they were telling him that they were taking the body back to Washington under no uncertain terms. So then there was a fight between the Secret Service and administration, and they demanded, was there any other way that the body could be taken back to Washington? At that time, they called Justice of the Peace, Theron Brooks, and he was brought in from Garland, and his inquest conceived of walking in front of the room, looking at the president, and signing the death certificate, so he was able to leave Parkland. Then, by that time, after the initial confrontation had held, a large coffin came in, the bronze one, the one that was in all of the pictures on the arrival at Washington. This coffin was brought in. The president was put in the coffin on a clear plastic mattress cover. The back of his head had been packed with gauze and some rubberized sacks, and he was placed, a sheet was over there, and he was then screwed down the coffin by the Mr. O'Neill of the O'Neill Funeral Home, and immediately a phalanx of the Secret Service walked in. I was so surprised that they surrounded the coffin that was on one of those dollies and was pushed out of trauma room one. Mrs. Kennedy then got up from her chair along with the fellow I found out was Admiral Berkeley, and they proceeded out of trauma room one into the major hall to leave Parkland. That's when they came in a confrontation with Dr. Earl Rose, who was the chief of forensic medicine. And there he told them that they were not taking the body out. It was against Texas law, and they had to have the autopsy there. And so another confrontation got where they said that they were taking him out, and a lot of bad words ensued. And I have no doubt that they would have rolled the coffin right over Earl Rose if he had not gotten out of the way. Now, the irony of this is, I really believe, Mrs. Kennedy, if someone who had been in authority had sat with her and explained to her the gravity of it, and that Dr. Rose, where he was in the operating room. They were going to do the autopsy there. They had already readied the neurosurgical room so he could perform his procedures, and it would only take him between an hour and 15 minutes. However, this was not to be. The Secret Service then rolled him out into the O'Neill funeral cart or hearse, and put the president in the back. Mrs. Kennedy got there into the back with Admiral Berkeley, and they left.
Well, now, after that, you were told that you were not to talk about what you had seen?
We were told never to write about this because I thought that the chief of the emergency room at that time, Dr. Baxter, felt that we would try to be getting undue publicity in starting a practice or a leg up, so to speak. It was called the Edict of Silence at Parkland.
And so you really didn't talk about what you had actually witnessed as far as the bullet wounds coming from the front until you wrote the book some years, well, almost 30 years later, 25 years later.
27 years later, and the I had already started the book that night. I was then on the next night on Saturday, and I called it 3 days at Parkland. But I was following the edict, and then I saw the autopsy photos that was held that were held by my co-author, J. Gary Shaw. He was the co-director of the Assassination Center in Dallas. And they were totally different from the body that I saw at Parkland and the pictures that were related to the autopsy photos at Bethesda, Maryland. And there was no question in my mind it was a cover-up.
And there was another thing that you mentioned in the book, and that is that when the body arrived at Parkland, it was in a gray casket, the body was in a Vietnam body bag, not in the sheets that you'd wrapped it in Parkland.
No, that was it when it arrived at Bethesda. Now, when he left Parkland, he was in the bronze coffin on the clear plastic mattress cover. Gerald Custer and three other people at Bethesda say that when he arrived, he was in a Vietnam body bag and in something called a carrying coffin. But we placed him, or the president, at Parkland in the bronze coffin that everyone saw in the movie.
And there's no question, when you saw the pictures that were part of the Warren Commission report, this was not the same wounds that you had actually witnessed.
Not at all. The hole that I spoke of earlier in the back of the head was completely gone. There showed no defect in the right rear of the skull. The small incision in the throat had been widened, it was gaping, and it was elongated another 3 centimeters or 1.5 inches.
And this wasn't the wound, the tracheotomy wound at all?
Not at all.
All right, fine. So somebody had altered the evidence to justify the conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald was the guilty party.
And that the bullets had to have come from the back, and this is not true.
Well, now, you mentioned in the book that after Oliver Stone's film came out, the doctors that were still at Parkland were once again told that they shouldn't be talking.
They were, he went out and asked all of us to sign releases to that our characters could be put in the emergency room scene. And there was some edict through the school that they wanted no publicity and that they were not really to talk to them.
All right. Well, have you come under any pressure for telling your story?
Oh, yes. It's been very intense.
Well, but you know, this is how they've managed to keep so many things secret for so many years, whether it be Pearl Harbor. We could give dozens of examples of massive cover-ups, and usually the right people of integrity are willing to take the pressure.
Absolutely.
And, of course, I write a great deal about the AIDS epidemic, and I can give the example after example of people who actually lost their jobs because they've told the truth or they've wanted to maybe address the AIDS epidemic. Stephen Joseph, who was the director of public health back in New York City in 1989, finally said, "We've got to begin addressing the epidemic as an epidemic." And that was about the last thing he said before he lost his job. Well, now, I think there's one other fascinating part of the story, and that is when Lee Harvey Oswald came in, you were at Parkland Hospital, and you had a call from the President of the United States.
Yes, that was on Sunday, and we did not have a television in the residence room there. We were sitting in the OR, of course, obviously talking about the President and the care that we were giving Governor Conley. And all of a sudden, the phone rang, and the administrator of Parkland Hospital, Jack Price, called up and wanted a free operating team. Well, it had been the quietest night in Parkland history, and so my team was off. And so those teams were operating. So I had the only free operating team. So I and 3 other residents went down again to the emergency room, and there between trauma room 1 and 2 was the administrator, Jack Price, who said that Lee Harvey Oswald had been shot and was being brought in. And one of the other things that I'll always remember is they were readying Common Room 1, where the president had died. And I suggested to the administrator they put him in Common Room 2, and there's where we took care of Lee Harvey Oswald. In 9 1/2 minutes from hitting the Parkland emergency room, he had 4 cut downs, 1 chest tube on the left, endotracheal tube, and was catheterized and was being pushed to the OR. And in 12 minutes, he was operated on the cart, betadine was spread over him, he was under oxygen anesthesia, and the operation began. So there was no delay in his care there at Parkland. After some of the other staff people started coming in, I scrubbed out because I was holding a retractor and sucking the large amount of blood there. I was tapped on the shoulder by a nurse and asked if I would take a phone call. So I went to take the phone call. But before that, I noticed a funny-looking man in the room. He was in a large man in a small scrub suit. He had a badge hanging out the front pocket and a gun in the back, his back pocket. And I wondered, you know, what is Parkland coming to? There were also people in scrub suits yelling at Oswald, "Did you do it?" There were obviously other people in the operating room. There was almost 20 there.
Well, before we go on to the next part of the story, we're going to have to take another break here. So if you'll just sort of hang on and we'll be back, because I think this is pivotal. It's not very many people who get a call from the President of the United States in the middle of an operation when life and death hangs in the balance. But we'll be back right after this short break, where we talk about Radio Liberty, the various books that we recommend to the public to read. So hopefully you'll want to get some of them. Next to your personal relationship with the Lord and your family, there's nothing more important to you today than your personal knowledge and understanding of what's really going on behind the scenes in America. To survive in times like these, you must be informed. Radio Liberty offers you books, tapes, and videos for your instruction. This month, we're recommending Pat Robertson's The New World Order, Going Into America's Invisible Government. To understand America's Christian heritage, The Myth of Separation by David Barton, the book or the video. To understand the part played by great foundations and their effort to promote socialism, foundations, their power and influence, and for an understanding of the AIDS epidemic, AIDS, the unnecessary epidemic, the book, the video, or the audio tape. For your order, call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Your order will help support Radio Liberty and keep it on this station. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8900. And this is Dr. Stan back on Radio Liberty. And Dr. Crenshaw, I apologize for interrupting you. It's a fascinating story because I've worked in emergency rooms under similar circumstances. Of course, when I was going through my medical training, I trained in orthopedics at the University of California. We didn't have trauma teams. You know, we were sort of whoever was there first had to put in the cut downs. I think we do a far better job than we did in those days. But anyway, could you go on and tell us more about what happened then when you got the telephone call?
I was standing there. I had scrubbed out. Dr. Shires had returned from Galveston and was leading the operating room along with Dr. Perry, Dr. McClellan again, and Dr. Peters. So I walked into the operating room supervisor's office, and I picked up the phone, and there was this booming voice. "This is the president, Lyndon B. Johnson. How is the accused assassin doing?" Well, I was taken aback. I said, "Well, he's holding his own. He's lost a lot of blood." He said, "I want you to take a message to the chief operating officer." So I said, "Yes, sir." It was more of a command than a request anyway. He said, "There is a man in the room, and I would like him to take a deathbed confession." So all of a sudden, the phone clicked off. So I went back and tapped Dr. Shires on the shoulder and said, "Guess who I've been talking to?" And I then told him that I'd been speaking to the President of the United States and that he wanted a deathbed confession taken by that man over there, the Oliver Hardy-looking person. Shires looked at me like I was crazy because there were 6 guys with their hands in blood and they were trying to save Oswald's life. And, you know, he gave me a look And I gave him a look, saying, well, he told me to tell you. And the thought that obviously entered both our heads, which we've talked about since, is even in the best of circumstances, he wouldn't have been able to make any confession for 2 or 3 days. Be that as it may, he then started into heart failure and arterial fibrillation. Then they did open chest massage on Oswald, and he died. So I went by this guy, and I said, well, there'll be no deathbed confessions today. So he disappeared. I never knew who he was. I don't know how he got there, how he got in a scrub suit. And, you know, a lot of people just melted away.
Well, you know, one of the things that's always puzzled me was the magic bullet. And I know you weren't taking care of Dr. Conley, but do you know anything about that? We were told that, you know, there were a lot of bullet fragments in Governor Conley, in his arm, in his leg. And yet the bullet that was found lying on the stretcher next to him was in pristine shape. How do you explain that?
Well, I cannot, because, as I said, being in coma now for 33 years, I've never seen a bullet like CE-299. This bullet supposedly came in and hit the president in the right shoulder. It supposedly, again, went through fascial components, bruised the right dome of the lung, and exited through the throat. Spector would stop his questioning after that. He said, is this possible, doctor? And any trauma doctor will say, yeah, a bullet can dance. This is possible. But then he wouldn't carry it any further, because the magic bullet then goes and hits Conley's right fifth rib, knocking out 3 inches. It goes through the lung substance, comes out the anterior chest, then goes into his right wrist, hitting the large bone there as an orthopedist, you know, and there were 8 fragments in that arm, and then another fragment went into his left thigh. And so Dr. Gregory, in debriding and opening this wound and taking care of the fracture, took out 6 fragments that I watched and gave them to Nurse Audrey Bell.
Now, these were 6 fragments of the bullet?
Of the bullet in the wrist.
Right.
And then the other fragment that was in the thigh was left in place after Dr. Shires and his team made sure that it had not gone through Hunter's Canal and was next to the bone. So there were 8 fragments, 6 of which were removed. There were 2 left in Conley's wrist, and the 1 fragment of the bullet that still, I guess, it was left in his thigh. And there was an outcry, of course, to have these taken, which I wished they had. Even the FBI was for that, because then we could have put to rest all the days for the magic bullet. And as you've seen, this bullet is pristine, and there's no way this bullet could have gone through these 2 men and doing 9 wounds.
And had left a lot of fragments behind.
Exactly.
And still be in pristine condition.
Absolutely.
Oh, there's a recent...
Also, this bullet was found on a cart that may or may not have been Conley's. It still has not been identified. No one now will say who found it, where it is, and not. Supposedly, the man that found it is dead, but it's very interesting that no one can really be sure.
Well, you know, there's a...
No hair, no fingerprints, and no tissue on this bullet.
For the continuation of this program, please turn the tape over now.